Hey, it's great to have you back for another episode of the Craig Rochelle Leadership Podcast. I'm honored that you spend some time with us every single month. And if you're new with us, we do new teaching on the first Thursdays of every month. But guess what? It's not the first Thursday of the month. This is a bonus episode. And what I wanted to do is try to add value to your leadership and share with you a new friend. His name is Chris Voss. He's the author of one of my favorite books that I've read in the last year or so. His book is called Never Split the Difference. It's all about negotiating. And the reason this guy is such a brilliant negotiator is because he was actually a 24-year veteran of the FBI. And he was the lead hostage negotiator. So if you can imagine, when someone's taken hostage in any part of the world, this guy would come in and he would be on the front lines of trying to negotiate the freedom of a hostage in that situation. This book is incredible. This guy is someone that you're going to want to follow. His book is Never Split the Difference. And so get ready to take notes. I promise this will be helpful. Let's now go to the interview with Chris Voss.
This is the Craig Rochelle Leadership Podcast.
Hey, Chris, it's an awesome honor to have you on the Craig Rochelle Leadership Podcast today.
Thank you very much. It is an honor. I appreciate it. Thank you for having me on.
So I'm kind of a fan. I've listened to your book three times.
Thank you.
And learned something new every single time. And I'm really, really excited to have our audience learn about your book, Never Split the Difference. And everywhere I go, I'm recommending it like literally several times a week. Some people, when I tell them about it, they think, well, I don't ever really need to negotiate. In my opinion, this is the best book on negotiating I've ever read, and
I've read several.
How would you help someone see that this book applies really to everybody?
Yeah, well, two things. First of all, the most dangerous negotiation is the one you don't know you're in. So anytime the words or the thought "I want" is in your mind, or somebody's trying to get somebody to say yes, and then there's another human being somewhere in the equation, you're in a negotiation. It's not just when money. Money as a commodity is probably involved in maybe a third of negotiations. I mean, the most important commodity that's in each and every negotiation is time. You're trying to get somebody to do something. You're trying to get somebody to take an action. As a hostage negotiator, you know, the term we use was behavioral change. But you're trying to get somebody to do something, you're probably in a negotiation.
See, I use this book, your techniques in parenting,
working
through conflict. It really is amazing, the principles. So you alluded to where you learned about this, and a lot of our audience won't know your background. My gut is because of where you learned to negotiate, your style and the necessity to get it right, it mattered more in what you did. Can you tell our audience a little bit about your background? Where did you learn to negotiate, and how's it different than many others?
Well, I worked for a relatively obscure federal agency, the FBI.
Right.
I was an FBI hostage negotiator. Eventually, I became the FBI's lead international kidnapping negotiator, which meant any American got kidnapped anywhere in the world. It was my job to figure out a negotiation strategy to get them out of it. And just to draw a fine line, you know, if you got arrested by the North Korean government, we didn't call that a kidnapping. That was an arrest, maybe an illegal detention. That wasn't my thing. But if your random kidnapper in Mexico who was just trying to make some money grabbed you, then it was my job to come up with a negotiation strategy, basically run a sting operation, get the hostage out, lay the groundwork for a follow-on investigation to get the bad guys. So that was my deal. I started out and I became a hostage negotiator when I was in New York, and I ran a hostage negotiation team in New York City. And then to become a hostage negotiator in the first place, I volunteered on a crisis hotline.
So Chris, we got a lot of people that are leaders. We got a lot of people that are kind of emerging leaders. What are some different examples in everyday business life? If I'm an entry-level employee that I'm trying to help influence others around me or lead up, what are some examples of different ways that people will negotiate, maybe not for a big land deal or commercial real estate deal, but just in everyday work life, Monday through Friday in the office?
Well, all right, so you're given a tough task by your boss, and you're not sure really how to handle it, and your boss is just kind of taking an attitude like, figure it out, you know, sink or swim. A really counterintuitive thing to do is with deference, because our approach is always deference. Deference works on everybody. We like approaches and skills that work 360 degrees. So believe it or not, you could say to your boss, do you want me to fail? The crazy thing about that is, instead of trying to get somebody, your boss or somebody else to say yes, people love to say no when they feel protected and safe when they say no. And especially when you've been given a difficult task by your boss, then your boss's reaction is going to be like, no. You know, it gives your boss the opportunity to rescue you, to help you out, to save you, which makes people feel really good. And also, this is what we would refer to as a calibrated no. And a calibrated no is usually worth at least 5 yeses. So not only will your boss say, no, your boss will immediately kick in with 4 or 5 more pieces of guidance that'll really help you out. And your boss at the same time is going to feel good about it and feel like they've mentored you, which then, of course, makes them more vested in your success, makes them, you know, really want to help you out even more, which is really what you want. And so you could use a calibrated no with anybody, especially with people in more powerful positions than you, because they just love it.
I'd like to stay on that topic for just a little bit more, because that, to me, was one of probably the top 5 takeaways of your book. I always thought a no was bad.
Yeah.
And you would actually teach that negotiation often begins with a no.
Well, it begins, yeah, because we realized that's what we were doing in hostage negotiation when I came across Jim Camp's book, Start With No, which was a business book. So Jim's idea initially was making someone feel like it's okay to say no, mm-hmm. which preserves their autonomy. And since their autonomy is preserved and they're not attacked, they're more likely to be collaborative. They're more likely to ultimately agree with you. And so Jim would say at the beginning of a negotiation, like, look, say no anytime. Like, you're free to say no and make me go away at any time. And then we thought, well, what happens if you actually trigger a no? What happens next? So we took it to the next level and found that, like, it creates this great collaboration, that the act of saying no makes people feel safe and protected. And consequently, feeling safe and protected, it tends to calm them down. And they think things through. And this even works. It's one of the few negotiation techniques that work really well when people are tired. Like when you're suffering from decision fatigue at the end of the day. I had an intern working for me who used to like to ask me how to do stuff all the time because he was horrified at getting stuff wrong. I mean, this guy was just too afraid of making mistakes. And finally, I sent him an email and I said, never ask me an open-ended question after 1 o'clock in the afternoon ever again. You got any questions for me, turn the question around so that I can say no and it'll move us forward. Because no matter how tired I am, no matter how frustrated I am, in any given day, I'm always going to be able to say no and it's always going to clear my head. And I made the guy a lot more effective and made our communication a lot more effective by switching over to that approach.
This is so counterintuitive. Because we tend to think, you know, I want everybody to say yes, 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 yes. But I even liked, Chris, you talked about, you know, if I called you on the phone and said, is now a good time? And you say yes, that's kind of a threatening place because you have no idea how much of your time I'm going to take up.
Right.
If I said, is now a bad time and you have the freedom to say no, it gives you the feeling of being in control. And that actually puts me in a better place when you feel comfortable and feel like you have the ability to say no.
Yeah, exactly. And nobody that works for me ever says, have you got a few minutes to talk? We all say, is now a bad time to talk when we call people on the phone. It's the change is just incredible what a difference it makes and how quickly we can become effective in our conversations.
The other thing that you said real quickly, and I want to give you a minute just to expand on it, is you said one no, and I can't remember exactly how you said it, but it can lead to so many more yeses. And this is something I did recently. I asked somebody, have you given up on this deal?
Ah, yes.
And what they said was, well, no. And then they started telling me, it was probably 3 or 4 things quickly of why they were still in it and what they would need to feel good about moving forward. And so I literally got many yeses, small yeses, out of giving them the covering and the freedom to say no. And so they felt empowered and then told me way more than I knew otherwise.
Yeah, it's crazy the way people's brains will kick into gear. And that's very consistent with what happens. They're gonna give you an awful lot of guidance immediately, which then, of course, then continues to vest them in the interaction. You follow that guidance, I mean, they're with you 100% of the way.
So you also talked about the phrase that I really loved, tactical empathy.
Yeah.
And if my memory's right, you were talking about emotional intelligence, kind of like emotional intelligence on steroids.
Yeah.
Which I love that. I love that phrase. Can you describe to our listeners what is tactical empathy and how is it a good tool to use in moving a deal forward?
Yeah, well, we know so much more about the way the brain works these days. And when people first started to use the word empathy, and I'm also trying to make the point that if we know what we're looking for, why do we just sit back and kind of wonder? Like, we know that negative emotions bang around in people's brains and at least 3 to 9 times more influence on their decision-making than positive ones. We know that. We also know exactly how to diffuse it. Now, hostage negotiators learned how to diffuse negative emotions back in the 1970s, but we're just kind of making it up and experimenting, you know, in high-intensity situations, and we didn't have neuroscience to back it up. The neuroscience now shows that negative emotions are dispersed, diffused, dispelled by simple identification, just by calling them out. Not especially don't deny them. Denying a negative is a really bad idea. But they did an experiment where they induced negative emotions in people. They could watch their brain activity. And then they asked the person each and every time to simply say, what are you feeling right now? Identify the negative emotion. And each and every time somebody identified that negative emotion verbally, the negative activity in the brain diminished. Not some of the time, every time. So let's take a tactical application of this knowledge. If I know that simply calling out a negative diminishes it every single time, and it's the biggest obstacle to agreement, then tactically, if I'm smart, I'm going to start with the negatives. And I'm going to say, look, it seems like you're really frustrated with how I've been dealing with you. And sort of internally, that's actually a very specifically designed phrase. In particular, in that case, I avoided using the word I. A lot of people in this thing will say, well, what I'm hearing is you're frustrated. That's a bad way to approach it. And you say, it seems like you're frustrated. That will tactically, that induces contemplation where a person internally in their brain says, am I frustrated? I was. And they don't know that it just went away. So we know enough about how this operates now from real specific science that it's just silly to make other choices. And that's why we refer to it as tactical. It's a tactical application of how we know the brain works.
So how important is it if we're in a negotiation with each other, is my end goal always get the deal done, or is there something else that I want to make sure that you acknowledge?
Well, it's kind of two things. I mean, as a negotiator, I want to find out the best deal possible, and I want a long-term collaborative relationship as a mercenary. Now, we always say, you know, pick a negotiation skill that both the mercenaries and the missionaries would like. As a mercenary, I want a long-term relationship because I'm going to make more money, I'm going to have more collaboration, I'm going to have less problems. So I like it because it works. You know, Daniel Goleman would refer to this kind of empathy as cognitive empathy, and he actually says the people that are best at it are sociopaths. And, you know, interestingly enough, what does that tell you? What that tells you is it's the most effective means of communication out there for durable, lasting, trust-based influence. Because sociopaths are lazy. They don't want to go back and rebuild the relationship every time. Now, second test, do the missionaries like it? Do I like to do it just for good reasons? Because as a human being, I want to have a great relationship with you. I want you to feel good about how we're working together. I want you to feel motivated. I want it to make you feel better as a human being. All right, so the answer to that is yes also. So our test is if it's effective, and it's just the right thing to do, kick it into gear and use it. Do not be deterred because sociopaths like it. Sociopaths use cell phones. Does that stop you from using your cell phone? No, it does not. It's only a tool. It's what's the purpose that you're using a tool for? And our purpose is so everybody prospers.
Chris, you said a quote something like this. One of your definitions of negotiation is the art of letting other people have your way. Is that how you said it?
Yeah, that's one of them, yeah.
So as someone who loves leadership, it seems to me that a good negotiation, would you say it's fair to say, is leading someone to a desired result?
Nuancing in the terms. A lot of this is based on what in therapy is called guided discovery. So are you leading them or are you guiding them? Mm-hmm. Depends upon what your leadership style is. But when you guide them to it, the guided discovery, which is why it's a great therapy tool, is then they own it more. You know, you point them in a particular direction or you shape their attention at specific things in a way that is gentle. It's guiding. And then when they discover it and they obtain epiphanies and they feel vested and they feel all in. And then simultaneously, you know, there's a gratitude there, which might be referred to as empathy. You want empathy being established as a two-way relationship. So yeah, it is a leadership issue. And are you leading them or are you guiding them? Ideally, you're guiding them because what seems like it takes more time initially actually will save you a lot of time long run.
So give us some practical questions to guide someone. If, let's say, you're in a hostage negotiation and they're making some kind of demand that's extreme, or maybe we're trying to buy a piece of property and the price is way too high, and you want to ask a question that's going to help guide them to helping find a solution. Give me, what's your best question you want to ask?
Well, I might say, when all this started today, what'd you have in mind? You know, that's a combination of a question. Well, I'm going to try to point you at a specific moment in time that benefits both of us, and that's the when, and the what is, what were you thinking, is a way to get you talking. It's a particular avoidance of the word why. You know, we might need to find out why, but why makes people defensive. My director of operations, my son, and he's convinced that, when we were little kids, anytime anybody said, why'd you do that? We learned that we were always wrong. You know, your parents never said, why'd you do that unless you messed up? So we started getting pounded into our head at a very young age. The why is an attack. Why is I'm getting ready to get in trouble for doing this? But you do need to find out why people are doing stuff. So you put a what in its place, and you might put a when to point their attention at a particular point in time. When this is all over, where would you like to be?
Talk to me about the how questions. If I'm asking for something big and you want to put it back on me to help solve the problem, how would you use the question how?
Well, I would say, how am I supposed to do that? People love to be asked how. You can ask it in a deferential way. Makes people feel in control when you ask them how. People love to tell other people how to do stuff. So we're using the word how to create a collaborative environment, but actually I'm putting it back on you. When I say how, I'm trying to load you down with the problem. You feel powerful because I've asked you how, but you don't know that I've just stopped you dead in your tracks. I've made you stop and think, triggered some in-depth thinking, and I've gained the upper hand, and you don't know I have.
Yeah, again, I think this is one of the big takeaways, at least for me, is if we're negotiating and you ask me how, I feel empowered. I feel like I'm in control, but what I'm in control of is solving your problem.
Exactly. Exactly. I put you on my problem. If you're creating the problem, which in many cases, you know, your adversary's got at least some share in the problem. That's why you're talking to each other. You know, I'm going to burden you with it, which is going to slow you down and also create this great collaborative environment.
Right. Well, you know, one of the things that also was a big takeaway for me, Chris, is if I'm in a negotiation with somebody, I always love to hear the words, you're right. Meaning like, hey, you know, Craig, you're right. And you would say that's actually not the best response. Can you kind of unpack that for us?
Oh, man, it's a horrible response. And, you know, we just don't know that. I mean, you're right is what we say to people to get them to shut up and stop talking. You know, if you're hammering me, if you're coming in on me, I mean, the only thing that you might like to hear better than yes is you're right. And if I want you to just shut up, I want to maintain a relationship, you know, either because I want to or because I have to. All I got to do is look at you and say, you're right. And you can get so happy.
I'm thinking marriage right now. I don't know how many times a month is like, okay, you're right. Go away. You're right. So there's something better than that you would teach.
Yeah, well, the 2-millimeter shift, to borrow a description from Tony Robbins, the 2-millimeter shift is you want to get people to say, that's right, instead of you're right. I mean, that's right is what we say when we believe 1,000% in what we just heard. It's this simultaneously triggers a subtle epiphany, and it's how to apply Stephen Covey's guidance from way back when: seek first to understand, then be understood. You, the other side is signaling to you they feel completely understood if they look at you and they say, that's right. And you, they're also telling you they just feel empathy from you, and that powerful desire to collaborate after that is incredible.
You wrote in the book, we fear what's different and we're drawn to what's similar. And then you introduced the powerful tool of mirroring. So let's say I'm in a discussion with a boss and I want to find out more. Can you kind of explain what is this art of insinuating similarity with the tool of mirroring? What is mirroring? How do we use it?
Yeah, and a great distinction we have to draw, because a hostage negotiator's mirroring is not, you know, the body language guy's mirroring. The body language guy's going to teach you, you know, mimic their physical moves. If he puts his hand to your chin, his chin, you put your hand to your chin. If, you know, if he crosses his arm, you cross your arms. We're not doing that. Do not do that. The hostage negotiator's mirror is repeating first the last 1 to 3 words of what someone has just said, word for word. And then when you get really good at it, then you'll shift from the last 1 to 3 words to the words that you want the boss to talk more about. So if your boss is giving you guidance and he says, you know, look, I want you to get this done by tomorrow. You might say, done by tomorrow? And the boss will say, well, yeah, because this, 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 and this. And that's why this deadline is important. And plus, I just like to stay ahead of the game. And then, because he's now completely forgotten you mirrored before, you could go, stay ahead of the game. And the boss will say, yeah, you know, because of this, 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 and this. Now, you've gotten a whole bunch of really good guidance. You haven't challenged them in any way, shape, or form. And when you repeat those important words that that the boss said out of their mouth, they feel this sort of resonance with you. They feel this synergy with you. And they want to go on, but in a different way, about the words that you mirrored. So it's actually a much better substitute instead of saying, what do you mean by that? I don't ever ask anybody, what do you mean by that? When they have said something that I want to clarify, I will mirror those words and I get a great expansion and clarity. Plus, they feel really good about giving me the guidance.
They do. It feels awkward at first to do that. You almost think they're going to notice this. But the truth is, it gives them the freedom to keep on talking, and it seems like people enjoy doing that.
Yeah, it's so invisible. And like you said, the first few times you try it, it feels so awkward. You're sure that they're just going to burst into flames or something right in front of you, start screaming at you and frothing at the mouth. And they don't even notice it. I mean, they just go on. They love it. They like it. It's a great stealth Jedi skill.
It is a great stealth Jedi skill.
Yes, it is.
I was just trying to.
Well, see, when you said that, and that's, like, I'm always drawn to responding to that. Like, when you said that, I feel myself being drawn to answer you and go on. And I know you're doing it to me, and that's why I laughed about it. I'm like, yeah, you know, and then I want to say some more. I mean, there's a delightful feeling on the other side, which works good for you long-term in a relationship as well.
I'd love to get your opinion, Chris. We have people write in every month and ask all sorts of questions. One of the most common questions we get, literally dozens each month, ask some form of, how do I lead up? How do I influence my boss? I think if they were going to ask it with negotiation language, they might say, how do I negotiate for more freedom? I've got ideas, and yet I often feel controlled. What advice would you give to someone to help a supervisor see, I can be trusted. If you give me a little more freedom, I might actually be able to get something done?
Well, yeah, all right. So if your boss is a control freak, they're fear-driven, right? And we talked before about how the fact that fear is scaring people, and it's the most dominating factor in people's decision-making. So you would want to go in and say, what do you want to deny with the boss? what you want to deny is that you can't be trusted to do stuff on your own. You want to say, I don't want you to think that I can't handle this alone. So the 2 millimeter shift go from denial to observation. And you'd say, look, it probably seems to you like I can't handle this alone. That is incredible relationship trust building. We refer to this as trust-based influence. You want to develop trust-based influence with your boss. And so you start out by diffusing the negatives, by just calling them out. I'm sure, you know, it seems like, it looks like, it feels like. Feels like, you know, you're really concerned about this project. It feels like you're under a lot of pressure. It feels like you got a lot on the line. Now, it doesn't matter whether or not your boss is actually under pressure. If they're control freaks, they feel under pressure. You need to begin to get yourself some breathing room. And you get yourself some breathing room by first just diffusing the negatives by calling them out. So then you ask a couple no-oriented questions. You don't want him wasting time with you sitting in his office. So you might say, do you want me to waste time in your office? Well, the answer to that's going to be no. Well, no, I don't need you that. I just need to make sure that I get things right. And you might mirror, get things right? Well, yeah, here's what I really need. When the boss lays out for you what he wants you to do, if you can fully summarize it to get a that's right, now the two of you completely agreed on the guidance, plus your boss feels really good about the interaction. Now you're going to go back out, and of course, you got to do what he says. And if you do what he says, they'll actually begin to look out for you. You know, this is not paying lip service to the guidance. If the boss gives you guidance that you know is not going to work, which occasionally happens, then you come back with, you know, do you want me to fail? Or a good how question of how much time do you want me to spend on a task that looks like it's going to have problems? Again, this is constantly giving it back to your boss to feel safe and in control, which then triggers them, if anything, will, into loosening up. What's your best chance of success? Your best chance of success is developing empathy with your boss so that they feel safe around you in your actions. And a follow-on is, you know, you got to take that guidance. You have to actually do what they want. If it's problematic, you got to negotiate with them in a way that they understand is problematic and change the guidance so that you don't fail.
See, I think one of the things that you said, and you just in introducing that idea, is really, really profound. If I'm working for someone who is a control freak, I can't remember exactly how you said it, but you said they're driven by fear. And so often I feel like I'm not trusted, but the reality is my boss or supervisor, he or she is really scared to death of losing control. And so I think if I can identify with that fear, that emotion, and they feel that I understand the pressure that they're under, that creates a bond that then creates a bridge that might lead to more trust.
Exactly. It's an indirect route to getting things done faster.
One of the things you talked about that was, I like the phrase, and I think it could be helpful to some people. When you talk about extreme anchoring in negotiation, what do you mean by extreme anchoring?
Well, you know, there's the anchoring of terms, dollars. You know, somebody wants to buy something for $10, and they start out by saying, like, look, you know, I'll give you $2 for this. I mean, that's an anchor on an offer. There's also anchoring of emotions. Emotions tend to be anchored negatively in terms of what people are afraid of losing. So I'm gonna change their anchoring on the terms by changing their anchoring on the emotions. And what do I mean by that? A quick example. An employee is in a job where they're shorthanded, and the boss is like, I can't give anybody any time off because a couple of people have quit. We're under a lot of pressure. So the employee happened to be someone we were coaching, needed some vacation time, knew the boss wasn't going to go for any vacation time, didn't want anybody taking any days off. She goes into the boss's office and says, I got really bad news. And then you shut up. And you let the boss's emotions anchor themselves. They're going to be negative. The boss is immediately going to think, oh, my God, you're quitting. Five people are quitting. You know, what's the emotional anchor there? And so finally the boss says, what is it? And the lady said, I need these 4 days off. And he says, oh, wow, I thought you were going to quit. Of course you can have the 4 days off.
That is so funny because I hear some version of that all the time, probably once a week, once every other week. I've got really bad news. I've got something horrible to tell you. And almost every time I feel relieved by it because it's never as bad as what I anticipate. And that's interesting. Along that line, Chris, I was telling somebody about your book and kind of bragging on it, how much it helped me. And they pushed back saying, well, that kind of sounds like manipulation, or cheating. What would you say to somebody who might take that attitude?
Well, it's the tool response. That same person, they'd be fine congratulating you. I mean, it's really an issue of whether or not you're sincere. Like if I tell you like this is the greatest podcast that ever was, you'd be like, yeah, thanks. You know, that's true. And by the way, it is a phenomenal podcast. Your downloads are insane, and you're putting out great content for people.
Thank you.
But compliments are manipulation. So it's kind of in the eye of the beholder. And that same person that says manipulation is bad, in many cases, they won't hesitate to criticize you. What are they trying to do? They're trying to get you to manipulate you into changing your behavior. So one man's manipulation is another man's influence. I mean, it's in the eye of the beholder. It's what are you using your tools to do? Are you trying to create great collaboration? Or are you trying to get people to do things that they shouldn't do? We're trying to create great collaboration. What the tools are capable of, it's in the hands of the person that's using them.
If people want to find out more about you, Chris, what's the best way for them to follow you or find out more?
Yeah, well, we put out a weekly complimentary newsletter called The Edge. And people who've read the book love it because it's a great supplement and it's a short, sweet read every Tuesday morning. It's not long. It doesn't wear you out. It kind of tees you up for the day, and it gives you your weekly recharge. And the best way to subscribe to The Edge, because it's a gateway to everything that we have, gateway to the website, gateway to training, everything, is to text the word FBI empathy and make it all one word. You know, don't let your autocorrect put a space in between and make it two words. One word, FBI empathy, no space. Send a text to 22828, and it's 22828, you'll get a response back that'll sign you up for The Edge, and it'll be a great supplement to the book. A lot of people really like it, and it's free.
Well, I want to tell you, Chris, thanks for your work. Thank you for the way you've influenced our organization, and appreciate you taking the time to be on today. If you write any more books, I'm going to be the first to order it, and just tell you a big thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks again for joining us at the Craig Rochelle Leadership Podcast. If you're enjoying learning from Craig on this podcast, you can show your support by subscribing, rating and reviewing on iTunes, and sharing with your friends on social media. If you're looking for the leader guide of this episode, you can go to life.church/leadership podcast. In that leader guide, you'll find a recap of this episode, discussion questions, and additional resources to hone your leadership skills. Until next time, thank you for joining us at the Craig Rochelle Leadership Podcast.